Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As we approach the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre next spring, my guest today, who's been a scholar of the event and a participant in the reconciliation efforts today, has written an account that combines the history of the events of late May and early June 1921 with the long history of acknowledging and reconciling those events here in Tulsa. Hannibal Johnson is the author of Black Wall Street 100, An American City Grapples with Its Historical Racial Trauma. It combines narrative, eyewitness accounts, survivor stories, and documents of the day, along with that long story of rebuilding and community acknowledgement through events such as the legislature's Race Riot Commission in 1997 and the Centennial 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Commission, which Johnson serves on, and also a look at how the community has begun to make amends. Hannibal Johnson is the author of a number of books documenting the African-American experience in Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, Up from the Ashes, Acres of Aspiration, Apartheid and Indian Country, and The Saunders of Chandler. He'll be participating in a Zoom interview with the Tulsa Historical Society coming up Tuesday, September 22nd at 7 o'clock regarding the new book. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Hannibal Johnson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Your new book, Black Wall Street 100, features a lot of eyewitness accounts, some accounts that I'd never read before, but also just a history almost in documents with your commentary over what has happened in Tulsa since 1921 in regards to how we regarded and are regarding the Tulsa Race Massacre. What was the reason for writing this book?
Well, we know that we're about to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, the worst of the so-called race riots, as they were described historically, in American history. And as we approach that moment, we will be attracting the attention of the eyes of the world. And what will be on the minds of those people who are observing what's going on at the ground level in Tulsa is, how is Tulsa different in 2021, 100 years after this devastating event in 1921? So what steps has Tulsa taken to heal its tortured history around race? And so the book is designed to really make sure that people understand that Tulsa hasn't been in a state of atrophy all these years, that there has been forward movement, sometimes in fits and starts, sometimes incrementally, but we are moving toward that really elusive goal of reconciliation that people talk so much about, but really have very little experience around.
It's interesting when you look at how other communities who also experienced, as you termed it, what was termed at the time, race riots, some cities have grappled head-on, others virtually ignored it.
Absolutely. It's hard history. I think we can all acknowledge that it's difficult. It causes us discomfort. But I think the real point is that we will ultimately experience much more discomfort if we continue to ignore the wounds of our history that fester over time. Part of the reason we're seeing some of the disturbances we're seeing around the country today is frustration over our failure to come to grips with issues of race that have bedeviled us since we became a nation. And so it's important that we acknowledge our history in an unvarnished way, that we make appropriate apologies for missteps that were made historically, and that we ultimately atone for those misdeeds of the past, that we make amends, that we provide reparations is a word that's used often, but it's used in a very narrow sense to mean monetary payments to individuals. I use reparations to mean to make amends, to right the wrongs, to provide a remedy. I use reparations as a term that is broad and encompasses a number of possibilities.
In Tulsa, you optimistically termed our own reckoning with the events of the end of May and 1st of June 1921 as something we've tackled in fits and starts. Well, I don't really think that start really happened till, 60 years after the events. This was something that was not talked about for a long time in the community. And it's interesting that when we finally began talking about it, there's still a degree of discomfort talking about these events well into this century.
Absolutely. And it should not be surprising that it's uncomfortable to talk about this tortured history that it involves at its core people's inhumanity to other people. And we also have to realize that we still, in many ways, live in racial silos. So we don't have intimate experiences with people from different backgrounds, at least not to the extent that we should. So coming to terms with this painful history and not having those intimate human connections across racial, ethnic, and cultural lines to engage around this history with makes it even more difficult, ultimately, to resolve the fundamental problems that have so long bedeviled us.
Well, in the book, you begin with an account that I'd never read before. It's Walter White, who was then the assistant secretary of the NAACP and later would come to lead that organization in the beginnings of the civil rights era. He came to Tulsa in the immediate aftermath of the race massacre, and he offered an eyewitness account, and it was a really eloquent statement. Why begin the book with this particular statement?
Walter White's account is, it's artistry in terms of the way he constructs the account.
Yes.
It comes from a man who, ironically, is a black man whose last name is White, but he is, in fact, white enough to pass for a white man. This is a man with sandy blonde hair, blue eyes, and pale skin, who frequently passed as a white man. So he was a sort of fly on the wall. He had access to information that most black people would not have from white people, because he could penetrate those circles of whiteness that black people generally couldn't get into. So his account is particularly perceptive and accurate because of that unique access.
You go from there and recount the history as we know it today, and begin telling us, you share survivor stories. What were some of the survivor stories that have really stuck with you the most? I know you've been involved in collecting these survivor stories and sharing those survivor stories. But what survivor stories have always stood out to you as the most penetrating and interesting?
The one that comes to mind immediately is from George Monroe. And I had the privilege of meeting and knowing a little bit George Monroe before his death some maybe 15 or so years ago. But he was a young boy, maybe 5 or 6 years old at the time of the massacre. The mobsters came over into his house, walked into the house, set the curtains on fire, were walking around. His mom had hidden George and his siblings under the bed. One of the guys who was vandalizing the house came into the bedroom, passed by the bed, and actually stepped on George's hand. Fortunately, George's older sister put her hand over his mouth so to keep him from screaming. And he remembers that moment where he was a young boy, terrified as people were ransacking his home. He recounted that story really until his later years. He lived to be probably late 80s, I believe.
You also include the documents of the time, the documents where Mayor Kirkpatrick sends a telegram to the governor calling out the National Guard. Later, T.D. Evans' message to the Tulsa City Commission and I hate to use the term whitewashing, but the complete whitewashing of responsibility of city leaders and the white majority of the time.
Yeah, you know, those documents are really important because leadership is important. And I think we can talk about the importance of leadership in the here and now in the year 2020. Leadership is always important. And the leadership in this community, which was white because we had a Jim Crow city, and the entire leadership structure was white men. The leaders of the community at the time said, as a matter of record, this was a Negro uprising. In other words, those black people over there across the Frisco tracks brought this devastation, this destruction, this death upon themselves. They need to understand their place. That was the message of the Tulsa Chamber, of the mayor, of the city commission. at the time. And to the extent that we are cultivating a new core of leaders in Tulsa today, they must know that history, because that is history we want never to have repeated.
You spend a good deal of time in the book talking about the 1997 commission that studied the Tulsa race riot. You re-interviewed some of the people that served on the commission, you know, asked them their memories, what they felt they did right, what they did best. Did it fulfill its mission? Tell us a little bit about focusing on this commission. Why is this commission so important?
Well, the original, what was called the Race Riot Commission, that was convened by the legislature in 1997 and issued its final report in 2001, is pivotal, because that really is a turning point in the awareness of this history. Because of other things that were going on in the world in 2001 when the final report was issued, the ending of apartheid and other things, conversations about reparations, the report generated a lot of interest, quite literally worldwide. And it's an award-winning report. The report was designed to find facts around the massacre and to offer recommendations. And it did those two things. So I had the privilege of interviewing Pete Churchwell, who chaired the commission, and Dr. Vivian Clark Adams, who was on the commission, African-American woman on the commission. And both of them thought that the process was sound. They were proud of the work that they did back then. They were proud of the attention that the report got. But I think both, to some extent, think that the report should be relied upon more than it actually is, that they spent all this time in a sort of broad way finding facts, making recommendations, and, you know, the report is not utilized as much or tapped as much as they would like it to have been. It is a wonderfully done document that is extraordinarily helpful in understanding the dynamics that led to the massacre, and it's also helpful in terms of framing discussions around reparations, because that commission made recommendations regarding reparations. They said that living survivors who could be identified should receive cash reparations. Heirs of survivors who could prove property loss should receive reparations. There should be an educational scholarship fund. There should be some sort of substantial memorial or monument. And that there should be some sort of economic development initiative set up to benefit the Greenwood District. So some of those things have been done. Others have not been done. But it really set kind of the frame for thinking about reparations.
My guest today is Hannibal Johnson. He's author and scholar on issues of race and diversity. His latest book is titled Black Wall Street 100, An American City Grapples with Its Historical Racial Trauma. And in it, he writes everything from poetry to narrative, along with a lot of document reproduction, as well as eyewitness accounts that he blends into this narrative as we approach the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Earlier, you were talking about thinking of reparations in the broad sense. The commission actually recommended cash reparations to survivors and to heirs who lost property in the riot. But I want to explore that idea of your idea of reparations, meaning something on the lines of amends, meaning more than just cash payments. What in your eyes would be proper reparations today?
So I think the first thing I would say is that none of the things that the commission recommended are improper forms of reparations. It's just that I would prioritize these things differently. So my number one priority in terms of reparations has always been curriculum changes, such that we incorporate this history into the regular curriculum. Give it its due, its rightful place, because I think that actually teaching this history, having people learn about and understand and discuss and debate and dialogue around this history, offers us a real opportunity to progress in terms of race relations from generation to generation. So that's an important form of reparation for me. The other thing that's important to me, probably secondarily, would be what we're doing with the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. So we are building Greenwood Rising, which is a history center. It's going to be a world-class, multi-million-dollar center that teaches this history in an immersive, experiential way and encourages patrons who visit Greenwood Rising to leverage this history to take on some of the race-based challenges that we face today, whether it's Black Lives Matter, mass incarceration, educational deficits, healthcare disparities, and on and on. So these are all forms of reparations because they are designed principally to address the wounds that we know are still festering, to make amends for historical misdeeds and missteps, and to ultimately bring the community together, move us farther along that path to, again, that elusive concept of reconciliation.
Greenwood Rising actually does fulfill one of the commission's recommendation, which was a memorial museum.
Right, right. So prior to Greenwood Rising, we looked to John F. Franklin Reconciliation Park, right, which was actually partially funded with state dollars, and it's intended also to memorialize this history. Greenwood Rising will both memorialize the history in some way, but also be an engaging, experiential opportunity for people to get sort of immersed in the history and then to use the history to think about it in ways that help us address current challenges that we face around race. And the Greenwood Rising will be linked to the John F. Franklin Reconciliation Park by way of what we call a pathway of hope, which will be a literal pathway that will connect Greenwood Rising and John F. Franklin Reconciliation Park, but also elevate some of the icons who built the Greenwood community along the way and teach people about their biographies and their histories. O.W. Gurley, A.J. Smitherman, A.C. Jackson, on and on and on.
And that's another story of the commission that really lamented the fact that the Greenwood district was really rebuilt without any help from the people who perpetrated the wrong. It was built on the back of the victims who survived and stayed.
Yes, and that to me is just another example of what's really important about this history for me. Fundamentally and universally, the history here is about the indomitable human spirit. So we know that the folks in the Greenwood community essentially took a vow that said, we shall not be moved. And so with little help from the larger white community, citizens of Greenwood rebuilt their community, actually to a degree that was bigger and better than ever. It peaked in the early to mid-1940s with well over 200 documented black-owned and operated businesses in the community. And the other thing that's interesting about the aftermath of the massacre and the challenges that the community faced is the role of the Tulsa Tribune, that daily afternoon newspaper. Yes. That was so pivotal in these events, publishing a series of inflammatory articles and editorials. Well, on June 4th, 1921, just 3 days after the conclusion of the massacre, the Tribune ran an editorial entitled, It Must Not Be Again. And it was a vile, offensive piece that really talked about the black community in ways that I'm going to choose not to utter on radio.
Right.
But it's important that we know about that because it just provides further testimony to the character or the spirit of the folks in Greenwood, that they would face this kind of hostility, yet, you know, vow to rebuild and to rebound.
If I can be a little more direct, but not go into the details of that editorial, it basically said the thing that should not happen again is not the white community invading the homes, burning the homes, looting the homes of the African-American community, that the African community should not be rebuilt.
Right. Right. It was existential in that sense, in that this community is not worth having, in other words. It wasn't worth it before, and it's certainly not worth rebuilding.
Yeah. Getting back to one of the things you talked about that's most important to you, the educational curriculum. You know, we know that there's been efforts, and real efforts in Tulsa to teach this in the curriculum, and there's been efforts to push this to the rest of the state. That has been far less successful, at least from my reading of events. What can we do to actually ensure that this is taught more, especially given everything that's happened in the last 5 years with, you know, continued stories of racial injustice and a mobilization of people against that injustice?
You know, one of the reasons I am optimistic is because of our ongoing relationship with the State Department of Education, Superintendent Hoffmeister, Senator James Lankford. We're all sort of rowing in the same direction in terms of the importance of getting this history taught. So we've worked on things like lesson plans and study guides. We are working on potentially getting some sort of greater influence over textbook manufacturers to get them to do a better job of including this as part of the regular texts that are used for Oklahoma history. We've even talked about how we could possibly incorporate questions about this history on state-mandated exams to give teachers yet another incentive to teach this history. So we're moving in the right direction. We have all the relevant parties at the table. We have a plan, and we are working toward that end whereby this history is given its rightful place in Oklahoma and American history curricula.
I want to ask you, Hannibal, about another recommendation from the commission, the business development incentives in Greenwood. And in the book, you have a section called Reflecting the Renaissance, and where you look at some of the development in the Greenwood district. And as I look at some of them, yes, I see some of them, and they are absolutely designed to combat the injustice that has been a part of our history. But others, I look at them as sort of, okay, we're going to put money into this community, but is it really for the community that historically called this area home?
Yeah, it's such a complex question, in part because much of the land in the core part of the Greenwood District is no longer in black hands, and it hasn't been in decades.
Yeah.
After urban renewal and other things as we know that have happened. So on the one hand, much of the history of the community, the legacy as a black community, is going to be found in places of preservation like the Greenwood Cultural Center, like the two historic churches that remain, Vernon and Mount Zion, like Greenwood Rising, which we're building. So the notion now is that these new entities that are coming in, there's Vast Bank, there is BMX, there are other folks that we hope that will bring economic opportunity on a broad level. This is an integrated community now. It's not an all-black community.
True.
There have been many changes since the heyday of the community in the early 1920s and then second heyday in the mid-1940s. So it's an integrated community. One of the things that we've stressed, the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission, is to promote this idea of the Black Wall Street mindset, which is something that is really not moored physically to the Greenwood District. It's the idea that, particularly for African-American boys and girls, that you can be, you can certainly be an athlete or an actor or an actress, those sort of popular professions and career paths, but you can also be an economic titan and an entrepreneur. You can be the next O.W. Gurley, A.J. Smitherman, A.C. Jackson, Mabel Little. Those are role models that you have historically. So we want you to be educated about those historical role models and know that you can do those things. You can have that economic and entrepreneurial spirit, the Black Wall Street mindset, and you can use that mindset here in Tulsa in the Greenwood District or in Manhattan, in New York, or in Los Angeles. Right, we live now in a market that is not closed and insular like the Greenwood District in its heyday. So let's figure out ways to take advantage of that greater opportunity in terms of markets.
Yeah, or by extension, 61st and Yale.
Right, absolutely. Wherever it makes business sense to do business.
Right.
Right.
My guest today is Hannibal Johnson. He's an author and scholar on issues of race and diversity. His latest book is Black Wall Street 100, An American City Grapples with Its Historical Racial Trauma. It's a combination of documents, survivor histories, his narrative, his poetry at times, looking at Tulsa's trajectory since the events of 1921 and the Tulsa Race Massacre. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, there's a really interesting book that came out this year by Walter Johnson about the death of an American city. And he's talking about St. Louis. But there's a lot of parallels to Tulsa and how our African-American community was treated in the 1950s and 1960s with urban renewal. And I think one of the most visible scars of this second dislocation is still sitting empty just on North Main, north of I-244, which of course bisected the Greenwood community and really tore it in half. And here it is. It was emptied how many decades ago, and it's still sitting empty this day. To me, that seems to be one of the places where if I see that developed in a way in which, you know, all people in our community can participate, and especially our African-American community, I will say, hey, we're on the right path. What are the things that strike you as today that we can do that will let you know that Tulsa is on the right path in confronting its racial past and embracing a racial unity in the future?
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, I-244, which bisects the Greenwood community, there are actually serious discussions going on right now about potentially moving I-244. And that's, you know, there's a massive project, a really, really expensive project, but they moved a section of a highway in Oklahoma City not too long ago.
This is true, yeah.
So the fact that we're even willing to have that kind of forward-thinking, futuristic discussion is really encouraging for me. I'm also encouraged by the fact that in recent protests, not just throughout the nation, but in Tulsa, I see a much more diverse crowd than ever, which makes me think that more and more people are coming to understand critical thinking around social justice. We are becoming a little more collaborative than we have been in the past, and that we are determined to do what we can to bring the city together. We're not perfect by any means. No city is perfect. But I think we have enough folk in place who are progressive and forward-thinking and social and racial justice advocates that we are on that path to reconciliation that I talk about so often.
Hannibal Johnson, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to visit with you.
Hannibal Johnson is a local attorney and author of a number of books on the Black experience in Oklahoma and a member of the 1921 Centennial Tulsa Race Massacre Commission. His latest book is titled Black Wall Street 100, An American City Grapples with Its Historical Racial Trauma. By the way, he'll be participating in a Zoom interview with the Tulsa Historical Society coming up Tuesday, September 22nd at 7 o'clock. You can visit the Tulsa Historical Society's website for more information on that event. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.